Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Al Franken, comedian, talk show host, and author of the hilarious and insightful book, The Truth, with Jokes. In the weeks to come, we have Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. It's a packed house here tonight for Al Franken, and I see it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. And it seems like you already know, but in case you didn't, when you buy your books here, you enable us to continue to bring you events like the one you're about to enjoy tonight. And while tonight's event may change your life, I wanted to point out that Dr. Andrew Weil is in our Cherry Creek store, but nonetheless, your lives are about to be changed. Would you officially welcome Al Franken back to the Tattered Cover?
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks back there. Thank you. Well, let me see. What can I say? Thanks for coming, and I hope you enjoy the book. Can we turn that off, or is everyone just going to get hot? Turn it down. Okay. Are people hot? Because I am, but I don't like the fan on. So, oh boy, what a hellhole this is. Okay. Now I love the Tattered Cover. I've done, and I'm glad to be back here in Lodo, which means lower downtown. Let me tell you about the book. I actually didn't really kind of want to admit that it's The Truth with Jokes, and it hit number one right away on the New York Times bestseller list, and that was very gratifying. And that was very gratifying, and I guess I've become a brand name. I figured out that what I kind of write is nutritional candy. The truth part is nutrition, and the jokes are the candy. This book I think is different from the last book in tone a little bit. It's maybe a little bit more serious because I think we live in the last couple of years things have gotten a little bit more serious. I still am proud of the joke craft in it and think it's funny, but there's some awful stuff has happened in the last couple of years since Lies. Also in Lies, I was doing a different kind of book. It was about the myth of the, of the liberal mainstream media, but how there is a right-wing media. So a lot of it was about O'Reilly and Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity. So it was a lot of, low-hanging fruit. sort of on the joke stuff. And this is more about this administration, particularly the White House, but also Congress and the corruption that we see, including the lying us into war. And I spoke a week ago Monday to the junior class at West Point, about 1,000 cadets, and I started them off with some jokes. I was smart. I got them laughing. But It was part of a lecture series once a year. It's just a once a year thing. It's actually the Sol Feinstone lecture series on freedom. And Sol Feinstone was a cadet years ago. His granddaughter was there, and she was my age. So I assume Sol was a little lonely at the academy, but I don't know, maybe not. And he did very well, I imagine, and endowed this lecture series, but it's on freedom. So I basically said that this... I talked about the fact that I'm going again to Iraq in December. I was getting them on my side, obviously, and how it was my sixth USO tour, and my third one to Iraq, and how my wife always says, you know, you don't see Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh going on a USO tour, and I say, that, honey, that's not fair. They have no talent. I've used that joke a lot, and I actually had at the Democratic convention last year. Sean Hannity was we were in Radio Row, and Sean passed by, and I coaxed him on the sitting with me, and I said something. I said, you know, my wife asked me, you don't see. She said to me, you don't see Sean Hannity going on USO tours, and I said, that's not fun. That's not fair, honey. He has no talent. And Sean said, that's not funny. And I said, yes, it is, and let me tell you why. You know, because it sounds like I'm defending you, but then I'm giving you little zits, because you actually can't go and, like, make people laugh like troops. And so I'm getting the troops laughing like this. And then I say to them, this is about freedom, and... ostensibly, now we're told that the reason that we went, that we're in Iraq, is about freedom. It's about bringing freedom to the people of Iraq. However, that was not the reason that we were told we went there in the first place. We were told that we invaded Iraq because there was a building threat that he would drop a nuclear bomb on us with one of his UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, that the president told us about in his speech in Cincinnati, which presumably would have a range of about 11,000 miles. Or that he would pass it off to Al-Qaeda, with whom he had an incredibly close relationship. In fact, as Dick Cheney said, it's been pretty well established that Mohammed Atta met with Iraqi intelligence right before 9/11 in Prague. That's been pretty well established, Tim. And of course, it hadn't been established at all. In fact, the 9/11 Commission reported that Mohammed Atta was actually in the United States at the time of the supposed meeting that didn't take place. But we were nevertheless told that Saddam was about to pass a nuclear weapon to Al-Qaeda. 65% of Americans felt that Saddam had something, when we went to war, had something to do with 9/11. It was, as I say in the book, it was 9/11 24/7. The vice president also told, also Tim Russert. I call Tim Russert in the book, I just keep referring to Tim Russert as the gullible, the easily fooled, the credulous Tim Russert, because, and it's really just, it's not fair to him, but it's because everyone just, the administration goes on his shows and lies to him, and he doesn't know any better. So, as you remember, Dick Cheney said to Tim Russert, Tim, and he said it three times. The fourth time he said, this is what he said the fourth time. He said, there's no doubt that Saddam has reconstituted a nuclear weapon. Now, later he said, I didn't mean, you know, I made a mistake. I meant to say what I had said three other times, and that's proof that I meant to say it, which is there's no doubt that he has reconstituted his nuclear weapons program. Which was a lie. No doubt means something. You know what it means? It means there's no doubt. That's what it means. No, honest, that's what it means. Really? No, I'm not kidding you. As we know, the International Atomic Energy Agency said he didn't have a nuclear program, but we weren't hearing that. Condoleezza Rice told us that the only physical evidence we had, of course, that there was a nuclear program that had been no doubt reconstituted, were the aluminum tubes, which Condi Rice said could only be used for centrifuging uranium, which is to make weapons-grade uranium, which is actually kind of the opposite of the truth, which was there's no way they could be used. And I got to tell you, I fell for it. I mean, Colin Powell, who has since apologized, at the UN, said talked about the same aluminum tubes, and he said, why would they be built to this specification, these fine specifications? Why would they have anodized coating unless they were going to be used for centrifuging uranium? I went like, holy shit. Anodized coating. I don't know what that is, but if Colin Powell says they have anodized coating and that means they're going to be used for centrifuging uranium, I guess the guy's got a nuclear program, and of course he's, you know. Oh, a few months later, after we were at war, by the way, Barton Gellman and Walter Pincus for the Washington Post went to Oak Ridge and talked to the father of centrifuging uranium for into weapons-grade uranium and asked him about the tubes. And he said, well, as the energy analyst had told Condoleezza Rice, they're just too small. You can't use them for centrifuges. Even if they were, you could use the size of centrifuge for of aluminum tube for centrifuging uranium. Before you did it, the first thing you'd have to do, of course, is mill off all the anodized coating. And of course, we were told that the British had learned that Saddam had sought to buy substantial quantities of uranium from Africa, which turned out also not to be true. And we were told that in the State of the Union address. We were told that Al-Qaeda had received, we're told by the president, we're told by Colin Powell, that Al-Qaeda had received weapons training in biological and chemical weapons from Saddam, from Iraq. That piece of information came from an Al-Qaeda detainee in February of 2002, or before February 2002, but in February 2002, the Defense Intelligence Agency told the National Security Council, which Condoleezza Rice headed, that that was fabricated, that the guy who said that had no way of knowing that, had no details, that was made up. That was widely distributed throughout the administration. But we didn't learn that until a couple weeks ago when it was declassified. The Senate did not have the same intelligence that the president had. They did not have the same intelligence that the administration had. And when the president says that, he's lying still. He can't stop lying. Now, I told this to the guys at West Point. And I said that you cannot have freedom without the truth. I've written a book called The Truth with Jokes. You can have freedom without jokes, which the Dutch and the Swiss have proved. I like that joke. This administration doesn't care about freedom. My first USO tour, I went to Uzbekistan. We had an air base there, K2, which served Afghanistan. By the way, I was completely supportive of the war in Afghanistan, and I was for, stupidly, the war in Iraq, because I believe Colin Powell. I'm an idiot. There is a presumption that the president won't lie to you. So when the Senate voted and Democrats voted to give the president authority to use force, when the president said, this is a vote for peace, this is a vote so I can go to the UN, this is a vote so I can go to the UN to get weapons inspectors into Iraq. When the president said that to the Senate, to the House, the Democrats believed him. Anytime you say that to a conservative, they go like, oh, come on, they knew. They knew this was a vote for war. And then you go, well, okay, but the president didn't say so. He said the opposite. He said he'd only go as a last resort. They knew. So it's okay for the president just to lie? They do it all the time. Really? 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 I am... when I go there, I love doing USO tours. It's a lot of fun. I go with... the Sergeant Major of the Army, who's the highest ranking officer, a non-commissioned officer in the Army. I'll be going with him again. I go also with country western singers usually. This year Daryl's not coming, but Daryl Worley, who wrote Have You Forgotten, which is a very moving and pretty jingoistic song, and he's very right wing. And I go with Mark Wills, who was... he's the guy who, remember, the president had the guitar after Katrina had hit and was in San Diego and was doing that kind of thing with a guitar. That was Mark Wills. And I had Mark on the show the other day because we're going on tour together again. And I just said, now, are people blaming you for Katrina? Because he goes, well, I'm getting a little crap for that. He's a right-wing redneck. And then I go with Bradshaw, who's a right-wing redneck, a wrestler, a great guy. And I love these guys. I just did a show with them on Friday in New York with the former Sergeant Major of the Army to raise money for vets. Daryl, the first time we came back, we were flying on this 10-day trip. We're flying back over the Atlantic on the way to Andrews. Almost everyone's asleep. Daryl and I are sitting there. We've gotten pretty close. He said to me, you know, when I first heard you were coming on this trip, I was incensed. I said, Daryl, why? And he said, well, I don't know why. I don't know. I didn't know what you were going to say. And I said, what did you think I was going to say? Did you think I was going to introduce you by saying, your president lied to you, and you are dying for no reason? Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Daryl Worley. And Daryl laughed, and he's a very... And actually, he played at the Republican convention this year and invited me on the third night to see him play a Tavern on the Green for the California Republican delegation. And I came. I went there, and I had a great time. He's a terrific musician. I mean, he really is a great musician. And just surrounded by these Republicans who were very nice to me. And this was the night after, the Georgia Democrat who gave the keynote speech, Zell Miller, gave that incredibly horrible, totally dishonest speech, saying that Kerry had voted to gut the military and he named all these programs that he had voted against. And mainly that he had voted against almost all of them in one single defense appropriations bill that people like John McCain voted against. You know, he didn't vote against, and there were all systems that he voted for. But these guys lie. They just do it. They just do it, and they don't have any shame. And it's amazing. And I don't know, I think when you do, I don't get it. I mean, obviously, these guys, they wanted to go to war against Iraq for whatever reason they wanted to go to war against Iraq. I mean, there are complicated reasons. I think they were self-delusional, and I think there was hubris. And it just continues. It continues. And we cannot have a real discussion about this war until they own their mistakes. That's all we ask, is that they own their mistakes. If the president would just come on and say, okay, look, I misled you a little bit when we kind of cherry-picked and exaggerated and hyped the intelligence and when we went in, and it's because I sincerely thought that my job as president was to protect everybody and that they might have it, and we've underestimated their weapons before, so I'm sorry. We oversold it. Okay? I'm sorry about that. We didn't send in enough troops. We fired Shinseki, or, you know, announced his retirement immediately after he said it would take several hundred thousand troops. I said in closed session 400,000 troops, which in retrospect would have been the thing to do. But Rumsfeld had this idea in his head that it would only take 100,000. We got 150,000 thanks to, you know, some fighting from the generals who finally just caved. But I'm sorry that we didn't send enough in because we thought that we told you we'd be greeted with chocolates and flowers, and we left out the key adjective exploding. We bought that Chalabi, who hadn't been there for 50 years or whatever it was. I don't know. I still don't pay much attention, frankly. We thought that he could just waltz into Baghdad and that we could leave and leave him there, and he turns out that he's probably a spy for Iran, and that was a mistake. I'm sorry about that. The looting, man, that we allowed the looting, enormous mistake, unbelievably huge mistake, and that the State Department, through the Future of Iraq Project, 1,500-page plan for the war and the post, and most importantly for the post-war, which I just totally ignored because it was 1,500 pages, and I can't read. I can't read more than about a page. It's just I'm smart. I'm a smart guy. I know I'm a people person. I can judge people. I've had people loyal to me for years that are very capable. They're dishonest, but they're capable. Like Carl Rove. I mean, he is completely amoral, but that's what I wanted. That's why I got him, and I'm a good judge of people. But I can't read. And that's another little apology I like to tell you. When we give you a list of the books like a guy took on vacation, that's a joke. You know that. I mean, but okay. But anyway, I didn't read any of the planning, and it all said don't allow looting because so did the CIA, and so did the Army War College, and so did the Council on Foreign Relations, and anyone who did any planning for the post-war said the same thing: don't allow looting. Most important thing is to maintain order, and we just ignored that because of hubris. It's that's a word that I've been taught by Condi, and I know what it means. It's been defined to me, and I understand it because I got it orally. It was explained to me. And I'm sorry, man, that was a terrible mistake. Evidently, $12 billion of damage was done to the infrastructure because of the looting, and it sent the message, of course, to the Iraqi people that we didn't really care about them, especially when Rummy said, hey, people in a free society are free to do what they want. And they aren't. We admit that now. We can't. Don't go out and loot, everybody. You're not allowed to loot. Sorry about that. Really sorry about the looting. The decision to when Bremer came in and had been there less than 4 days to disband the Iraqi military. Wow, dumb. Dumb. Telling 400,000 troops in the Iraqi army, you're fired, we're not going to pay you, get out of here and take your weapons with you. Very stupid. Very, very stupid. And by the way, there are huge weapons caches and caches of high-grade explosives not far from here that you can that we can't guard because we didn't send in enough troops, you see. That, all of that, terrible, terrible, terrible mistake. The contracting to people like Bechtel and Halliburton, giving no-bid contracts for 5 years, a five-year no-bid contract. Anyone who does contracting knows you don't give a no-bid contract for more than 6 months, usually. We gave a five-year contract. Well, it was corrupt. It was lining the pockets of our pals, and I'm sorry. I apologize, really, honest. And then not actually allowing the Congress to do any oversight of the corruption because we told them we'd punish them. Because we do that with our Republicans and them not doing any oversight and the fact that all the money that was so much of the money anyway that was supposed to go to reconstruction of Iraq and getting the water up and getting the electricity up was stolen and there's $8.8 billion missing from the Coalition Provisional Authority. That's I'm sorry about that, because what it did was it really alienated the Iraqi people, because they didn't have electricity, they didn't have water, there was sewage all over the place. Pregnant women were losing their babies because they were getting diseases from the water, and what that did was fuel the insurgency, and it's killing our soldiers, and I'm sorry for that. I shouldn't do this. My publisher will kill me. There's a book, another book out that you should read, called The Assassin's Gate by George Packer. It's a very George writes for the New Yorker. He was for the war in Iraq when it started, and sort of ran a very similar track that I did, except that he went there really as a journalist and did a tremendous has done a tremendous job. History is not going to treat these guys well at all. And we got to take back the country. We got to take it from these guys. But until these guys because when I go there, and this, by the way, I'm talking about part, just a little part of this book. But when I go there, and I don't think I mentioned the USO tour once in the book. I don't know why I'm talking about what I'm talking about tonight, but I am. Well, it's because the president has said last week that anyone who says that he lied us into the war is changing history. When I go there, I'm entertaining and talking to and eating with kids. They're my kids' age. And I visited them in Walter Reed, and I visited them in Bethesda. And we didn't give them the proper armor. You know, when we first went in there, this administration tried to cut combat pay. They tried to cut the benefit that family gets for a soldier killed in action. In the book, I write about Rumsfeld was signing the killed in action letters with an auto pen. And he lied about it. He was asked about it. His office was asked about it. They said, no, he's not doing that. Finally, they compared enough the letters. And he was signing with an auto pen, and then they admitted it. These guys are not going to look good in history. The book is divided in three parts. First part is called The Triumph of Evil, which is about the last election. And that's divided into three parts, fear, smear, and queers. Fear is really about ramping up. By the, you know, you'll notice we haven't had a you know, an elevation in the security alert since the election, nationwide. We had a lot of them before the election, didn't we? And you know that Tom Ridge, since the election, has said that they'd often raise the security alert to orange, and he'd say, why? What for what? Smear, they took a war hero and smeared him. Queers, of course, was trying to exploit the issue of equal rights marriage. I don't understand how gay marriage threatens my marriage. It's not like I'm walking down the street and see two guys with holding hands with wedding bands and just say to my wife, God, you know, honey, that looks pretty good. You know, I don't like football, and I love football. I love football. You don't like football, and maybe I could find a guy who likes watching football and marry him, and then on Sundays I could spend the day watching football with my husband, and then if I wanted to have sex, I could come home and have sex with you. My wife has said I don't totally understand the whole concept. But anyway. But I was talking to Newt Gingrich the other day, and I said to him, don't you want for a gay couple the same thing that you had with your first wife? Don't you want what comes with that pledge of fidelity? Don't you want that same thing that you had with your second wife? Don't you want that bond that comes from a lifelong commitment that you may or may not have, I don't know, with your third wife? I don't know quite what the deal is there. I don't get it. Second part of the book is called The Seeds of Collapse, and it goes into things like the Social Security debate, which I just went to town on that one. It's one of my favorite chapters, and I love figures. I love Social Security because it has so few moving parts, and I can wrap my head around Social Security. And what was great was seeing the administration, the president, who finally realized that the American people actually didn't want to change Social Security. He realized this on, like, you know, day 75 of his 60-day tour. the rationale that would change, there was a crisis. The crisis was, is that, first the crisis was going to be that starting in 2017, there was going to be more money flowing out of the trust fund than in. So I called an economist at Brookings, and I said, take the president's plan as we know it now from the commission. When he's saying in 2017 there'll be more money coming out of the trust fund than going in, under his plan, when would that happen? He said, under his plan, it would happen as soon as they started the plan. So that wasn't a crisis. That wasn't the problem. Then the problem became there was no trust fund. Remember that? He went to West Virginia and he looked at the, you know, chest of drawers where the treasury, you know, the trust fund is represented, and he went, these are worthless. U.S. Treasury bonds, worthless. Wow. I thought they were the safest investment in the world. But now you're telling us they're worthless. Did the Chinese know that? Don't tell the Chinese. Because then we aren't going to have any money. Okay, well, then that stopped, because then, remember, part of the private plan became that you could just get treasury bond. And it turned out that Bush has all, you know, millions of dollars in treasury bond. So then that wasn't the problem anymore. Then it was the long-term shortfall. Is $11 trillion. Remember that figure? You kept hearing $11 trillion, or $11.1 trillion. Okay, well, what was that? Well, it turns out that was computed by the trust fund's actuary over the, quote, infinite horizon. Well, what does that mean? That means that's the shortfall of the Social Security system going out to infinity. So I'm thinking, that's not so bad. That means over the first 11 trillion years, it's just a dollar a year. And after that, you're done. And, of course, the American Actuarial Society took them to task for some of their assumptions. One of the assumptions to get at this $11 trillion shortfall to infinity was that people would live to 150. No, I'm not kidding you. There's this great press conference where Secretary John Snow, Secretary of Treasury, remember who they said he can stay as long as he wants, as long as it's not for long? Remember they tried to get rid of him, but they couldn't find anyone who would actually become Secretary of Treasury under under Bush, because nothing makes sense. Anyway, so he said he comes out to announce this $11.1 trillion shortfall, and someone who knows what's going on says, well, doesn't he, I mean, that's over infinity, yeah. And the assumptions are living to 150, that's right, and retire, you'd still retire at 67, yes. Which is, by the way, an 83-year retirement. By the way, I've consulted biologists and doctors and who do research. They say that in the future, it may be possible for human beings to live to 150, and that if that happens, the first 50 years will be great, the second 50 years will be kind of okay, and the third 50 years will be absolutely horrific. Anyway, so I go into the Schiavo thing, which you remember Bill Frist diagnosing Terry Schiavo from the videotape, which one of the things I'm gratified about is the Bill Frist cam is dead. It's just not going to pass. As you know, that was legislation that would put a camera in every intensive care unit in the country that would pan the ICU unit, and Bill Frist would sit in his office and look at all the monitors and give people thumbs up or thumbs down. And I'm just glad that's gone nowhere. Not gone anywhere. That's good. I write about Jack Abramoff and just the unbridled corruption of this Republican Congress and the lobbyists and Tom DeLay. It's ugly. It's ugly. When I finished writing this book, I consider the book very prescient, because when I was writing it, there are actually people in this country who thought this president was competent. No, there were. Remember, I don't know if you can remember that back that far. The last part of the book is called the Resurrection of Hope, and it's in the form of a letter to my grandchildren, written in the year 2015, and it starts out, "Dear Barack, Hillary, and Joe the Third." Joe the Third is my son is Joe the Second. My dad was Joe the First. First of all, I believe that we have to take the country back. We have the opportunity to take the country back, but the only way we're going to take the country back is if we show that we deserve it. And to show that we deserve it, we have to articulate a vision and a plan and an agenda that makes sense. So I talk about, in this letter, about all the Americans who stood up during this dark time and took our country back. And I talk about part of it is it's taking the House in 2006 so he gets subpoena power. And so by 2008 it becomes apparent a lot of the stuff that's happened. In the book, and this is just, remember, it's just the book, I am elected in 2008 to the Senate. And but it's a book. And in the book, I say I don't decide till 2007 whether I'm running or not. But a lot of people don't realize this, but the new Congress comes in session about 2 weeks before the inauguration. So as a new senator from Minnesota, I suggest to my colleagues that we, and to the, my colleagues in the Congress and the House, that we impeach the president. And they... And all the Democrats say, well, why bother? He's only got 2 weeks left. And I say, well, because, you know, because we can. And everyone just sort of takes to the idea. And there's and so there's a quickie impeachment. And it's very fast. In fact, in just one afternoon, the president is impeached, convicted, and starts drinking again. It's... But and then I talk about the our agenda in the first 100 days: universal health care, an Apollo program for renewable energy, a real investment in our schools, a real No Child Left Behind program. Restoring faith in something called science. And all of these actually come out of values. And I think that one area we have to win on, and I think we can, I know we can win on, is on values. Because if you think about it, universal health care is about the value of every kid having health care. We, on the show, we do this metaphorical road tour. Now we're on a real road tour. But where we go, we do this 50 states in 50 days things. We talk to, because so much is now happening in the states because the everything's controlled by the Republicans in Washington. So in Illinois, we talked to Governor Blagojevich, which, by the way, he didn't even know this. In Serbian, means a son of a boring Gentile. Blagojevich. And anyway, he has introduced a bill called All Kids, and it's just universal health care in Illinois for all kids, every child. A child who is not covered, does not have health insurance, is 70% more likely not to get treated for an ear infection. They're less likely to go to school. They're much more likely to miss school. We have to ensure not just all our kids. We are the only industrialized country that doesn't have universal health care. We spend about twice as much as any other country on health care per person and have worse outcomes. We are not that much dumber than the rest of the world. We can do this. What kind of world, what kind of planet we leave to our kids is, and our posterity, is a moral issue. Global warming is happening. I went to a climate change conference in Aspen, about 6 weeks ago. Climatologists, there's this absolute unanimous consensus among all scientists, all climatologists, that global warming is happening and we're causing it. There are some scientists who think the jury is out. They're all paid by oil companies and the Heritage Foundation through oil companies, or the Cato Foundation through oil companies. For some reason, these scientists paid by the oil companies, there's a coincidence. And at this conference, there were not just climate scientists and marine scientists, who, by the way, the oceans are warming up, and the average hurricane in the last 30 years has 70%, unleashes 70% more energy. The average hurricane. They last longer and they're stronger. And they're bigger. Because the ocean's heating up. The ice cap is melting. The ocean level is rising. This is a moral issue. And at this conference, there were faith leaders. We had someone from the Southern, we had the, one of the vice presidents of the Southern Baptist Leadership Conference. We had evangelicals there. Richard Cizik, who's a very, very well-known evangelical. Because this is about values. When Terry Schiavo happened, when the Congress suddenly met on a weekend, they had to meet on a weekend to get this feeding tube back in this woman in Florida, a tragic case, but it had been adjudicated in Florida where it was supposed to be adjudicated. They had ruled that the husband had the authority to ask that the feeding tube be removed based on his interpretation of his wife's wishes. Suddenly, they weren't for states' rights anymore. They were wanted to federalize this. But it was because they had to meet on the weekend, and the president had to fly on a weekend, interrupt his vacation in the middle of the night to sign this bill because they were about the culture of life. A couple days later, we had Jeffrey Sachs, who oversees the Millennium Goals, the Millennium Development Goals for the UN. And these goals are to have extreme poverty by 2015, to provide AIDS medicine to people infected with AIDS around the world, clean water, sustainable agriculture, universal elementary school for kids around the world. And he said to me, can you imagine if the Congress met an emergency session on a weekend because they were really concerned about a culture of life? Can you imagine if they met to address the 8 million plus people who die every year from extreme poverty? Wouldn't that be something? We can beat these guys on values. And we are. I want to read God, I hope I can do this. This is a chapter called Al Franken Talks About God. And sometimes I get through it fine, and sometimes I can't. And you have to understand something about me, which is that I cry at McDonald's commercials. Okay? You know, a really sappy McDonald's commercial where they hire a special person or something. I'm crying, okay? So bear with me. I'm going to try to get through this because it's about my dad. Okay. Al Franken talks about God. I'm Jewish. Thank you. So I suppose I'm not really in much of a position to argue that conservatives have hijacked Christianity, and I haven't read the New Testament from cover to cover. But from what I understand, if you cut out all the passages in the Bible where Jesus talks about the poor, about helping out the least among us, if you cut out every one of those passages, you'd have the perfect container to smuggle Rush Limbaugh's drugs in. My views about God come from my dad, who died 12 years ago of lung cancer, which brings me to a funny story. Dad died at home. My brother and I both came back to Minnesota to be with him and Mom for what turned out to be the last 3 weeks of his life. About a week before Dad died, we got a call from Rabbi Black, who asked me if he could come over and talk to Dad. I thought about it for a moment and told the rabbi that I didn't think so. Dad knew he was dying. We knew he was dying, but we never discussed it as such, and I just didn't want Dad to have to talk about his death unless he brought it up himself. A couple days later, Rabbi Black called again. Could he come over and comfort my mother? Well, Mom was a total wreck by then, and if someone was capable of giving her any comfort, It would certainly have been a relief for me and my brother. Sure, Rabbi. So Rabbi Black came over and sat in our living room with the three of us for however long, and I don't remember a thing he said, other than, would it be okay if I could see your father? The thought instantly crossed my mind that the comforting mom bit was just a way for the rabbi to get his foot in the door to get at Dad. But I felt guilty immediately for even thinking that. I was kind of a wreck myself. I told the rabbi I checked with my dad and went down the hall to his bedroom. By now, Dad was down to about 75 pounds and extremely weak. But he was still totally on the ball. I said to him, Dad, Rabbi Black is here, and he was wondering if he could talk to you. It took Dad a moment to gather his breath and say, well, I don't really know him. Rabbi Black was new to the temple. Then with a shrug in his frail voice, Dad said, but if he feels it'll do him some good. I laughed really hard, and Dad smiled, a happy, satisfied smile, because his son had given him the best gift you could receive in our house. I laughed at his joke. I went back to the living room and told Rabbi Black that Dad would see him. The rabbi spent about half an hour with Dad, who died 5 days later. Rabbi Black presided over Dad's memorial, where I told the if he feels it'll do him some good story. Everyone laughed, especially Rabbi Black. It wasn't until a few months ago that I heard the rest of the story. I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Rabbi Black now has a congregation. Our radio show was touring the Southwest, and I invited the rabbi to be part of the audience. Before the show, we sat in a small office at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, and I asked the rabbi how his talk with my dad had gone. The rabbi smiled. Oh, he tried to make me feel as comfortable as possible. That was my dad. Joe Franken was born in 1908 in New York City to immigrant parents. His dad, my grandfather, Otto Franken, died of tuberculosis when Dad was 16. So Dad went to work and didn't finish high school. He never had much of a career. Dad was a printing salesman for the last 30 years of his working life. But everyone liked Joe Franken. He and Mom were married 53 years. They bickered sometimes, maybe more than sometimes, but were completely devoted to each other. Mom pretty much fell apart after he died. Neither of my folks was particularly observant, but my dad liked going to temple. Mainly for him, it was a social thing. He was an usher, and he loved the music and the sermons. Rabbi Shapiro, the rabbi he knew, spoke from the Bima about Jewish religious philosophy and the requirement that Jews not only be just, but that we do justice. Unlike Mom, Dad was comfortable talking with me about religion and God. He believed in God, but not as an old man with a long white beard sitting in heaven. In many ways, Dad's view of God was like our founding fathers, not Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and James Madison, who were not really Christians so much as deists. To Dad, the Bible, meaning the Old Testament, was not to be taken literally. Woman evolved along with man through natural selection, not from Adam's rib. The work of God could be found, as our founders believed, in nature. Dad told me that he believed nature, which to him included humankind, to be so beautiful, so magnificent, that there had to be something behind it all. That was it. That was Dad's idea of God. Something behind it all. It was no more or less complicated than that. For Dad, the rest of religion lay in the ethical teachings of Judaism, and to the extent he had absorbed them, of any other faith, Western, Eastern, or whatever. Again, not so different from our founders. In their famous correspondence at the end of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote a lot about religion. When Adams concluded that his personal creed was, quote, contained in four short words, be just and good, Jefferson replied, the result of our 50 or 60 years of religious reading in the four words, be just and good is that in which all our inquiries must end. So if your definition of traditional American religious values starts with the founders, you could say my Jewish father's values were as traditional as they get. Jefferson, of course, had sex with a slave, which Dad would have disapproved of. Mainly on the slavery front. My conception of God is pretty much the same as Dad's. And like him, I respect other people's religious beliefs. I know they derive tremendous inspiration, joy, and solace from their faith. I also expect others to respect my beliefs. That's also a traditional American value. I consider myself a very fortunate person, most of all because I've been extremely lucky in my family life. Even though my wife and I had not been totally abstinent before getting married, we will be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary a few weeks before this book is published. How have I managed to stay married for 30 years, many of them happy? I credit fear. My fear of being alone. Also, there's Franny's willingness to tolerate me. And, of course, we're a family. I'm not a big one for prayer, unless you consider counting your blessings as praying. I am grateful every day for my two unbelievably great kids. Please indulge me in a moment of fatherly pride here. Both my kids are smart, happy, funny, and kind. Those of you who listen to my show know I brag way too much on my daughter Thomason and the fact that she teaches third grade at an inner-city public school in the Bronx. She hates when I do it and always asks me to stop, which makes me even more proud of how modest she is. She didn't get that from me. My son is Joe after my dad. Here's another point of pride. At Joe's high school, they give out one prize to a graduating senior. There are no academic awards, no valedictorian, just the Billy Farrell Award, named for a particularly beloved student who died in a car accident a number of years ago. Essentially, it's the Mensch of the Year of the Class Award. And you know I'm telling you this because the school presented Joe with the honor. Of course, I credit his mom, mostly. You see, when Joe was about 8 years old, he was over at another kid's house, and the kid's mom asked Joe why he was such a nice guy. Joe said, "I think it has something to do with my grandfather." Is Dad in heaven looking down, giving that smile he gave me when I laughed at his joke? I have no clue. Actually, I really doubt it. But I know he's part of me and a part of everyone who loved him. I think somewhere in there is God. Thank you. Let's do a few minutes of question and answer. I went on longer than I usually do, and I don't know why. I have no idea why. So we'll have less time for question and answer, but I'm sorry. So raise your hand, and then I'll call on you, and stand up, ask the question. I'll repeat it so everyone will have heard it. Yeah. Okay. If I was big on universal health care, why did I support Kerry? Well, Kerry, I considered there to be two candidates, Bush and Kerry. And you know, Barney Frank once said that he only voted once for a guy who believed everything that he believed, and it was him. The first time he ran. Yes. I don't know if I'm running for the Senate, but thanks. Okay, the question is a question I get a lot, which is about the voting machines, and specifically the Diebold machines, but these voting machines that don't have a paper trail or don't have a way of checking on whether we're getting an accurate count. I do not believe that this election was stolen. After the election, I was extremely careful. A number of people, some people on Air America started claiming that, or more than suggesting it, I mean really saying it, and I wanted to be very careful. We got a number of people who this is their what they do. A guy named Ansola Bahari at MIT, a guy at Cornell, a guy at Caltech. Ansola Bahari is one of the leaders of the Caltech MIT voting machine project. He is someone who I talk about, I quote him in the book, or quote his studies in the book, not about this, but about other things. They concluded that this election was not stolen by these machines. And they did that on the basis of exit polls. And I was satisfied that this was not a stolen election. The fact that people think it was, or suspect that there was, is really bad for our democracy. And it is absolutely essential that we have some kind of paper trail or accountability for these machines. These machines aren't the right way to go in elections. They have other ways of doing this. But ain't nothing's going to change until Democrats get in, because Republicans are just, I don't know, they just don't. They don't want a paper trail. They don't want accountability. And I don't understand what the harm of it is. I mean, they say it's expensive, I guess. But I mean, what is the price of having people believe that the elections aren't fair and can be stolen? You know, there was the garden variety trying to steal the election in Ohio that usually goes on and we should not have secretaries of state running the election apparatuses. And this goes to, you know, states with Democratic secretaries of state too. It just is wrong to have the election process run by people who are the campaign chair in a state of the Bush campaign or of the Kerry campaign running the electoral apparatus, or you know. And I would like to see in Ohio, and it went down on election day. They tried to get pass a thing where they have that congressional districts are drawn in a nonpartisan way, that and elections are run in a nonpartisan way. And boy, would I like to see that. And I'd like to see it uniformly across the country. The problem is, of course, that each state is controlled by a party, you know, and they're not going to cede their authority when other, like Texas, obviously redistricted in the middle of a decade, which is very high, you know, just and did it corruptly. Of course, they won the legislature by taking corporate money, and we know that DeLay is under indictment for that. So the electoral apparatus in this country has to be, you know. I also think elections should be done either on weekends or it should be a holiday. I mean, why put barriers to voting that are really ridiculous? Yes. You mean giving tax breaks to oil companies for exploration and then asking them for windfall profit tax? I mean, obviously, the first part was stupid, I think. Oil companies are incredibly profitable now. And because of various facts. I mean, we have to get off the oil schneid. We just have to get off it. But in the meantime, we, you know, we should make these companies, because these are windfall profits, you know, help. And they aren't doing it. Then help poor people who need heating oil this winter. I mean, that's the immediate need, and it's very immediate. And they're not. There's a program called LIHEAP, which is that's what it's for. It's to give low-income people, you know, assistance for heating. And the Republicans won't raise that. And the oil companies should be paying. We've had windfall profit taxes before, and we should have it now, and we should have it again. And but mainly what we have to do is develop alternative sources of energy and conserve. And today we had the mayor of Boulder on, and he talked about how he's, with eight other mayors, wrote a letter to all the mayors in the country months ago and asked them to essentially voluntarily adhere to Kyoto, the Kyoto goals. And now there are over 200 cities that are doing that. And this was led by the mayor of Seattle. You know, President Bush said of Kyoto that if we follow the Kyoto Protocol, it would ruin our economy. The opposite is the case. There is no doubt that if we continue to burn this much oil and release this much carbon into the atmosphere and let it be absorbed by the oceans, that we're headed for Katrina every month in 20 years. The ski industry is frightened that there will not be a ski industry here in Colorado in 30 years. This is insane. But we got these oil guys. Okay, I'll go with you. And then we, yeah, okay. And Mark, I'm not going to call on you because of Mark Luther, our resident ditto head, please give him a warm welcome. Mark, Sarah. That's Mark's sister. And Mark is just sitting there hating every word I say.
I'm not.
So I'm sorry, I called on you and then rudely interrupted you. Well, the question is, we have a lot of Democrats running all over this country, good Democrats running to take back this Congress. What should we do to respond to the mother of all smear machines? And they smear. I've talked about running for the Senate, and everyone who talks about it said, "Oh, Al, don't. They're just going to smear you. They're going to go after every word you've ever said. They're going to, and worst of all, they're just going to make shit up. I mean, that's what they're really going to do." And they do. They already do. I mean, I already got. Believe me. And, you know, and that just makes me want to do it more. Because fuck them. That's another thing. If I ran for Senate, I can't say that anymore. I won't be able to say it. Well, the vice president does, but in the privacy of the Senate chamber. I always thought in the debate, remember when Cheney, and it was a lie, too, when he said to Edwards, "You know, I preside over the Senate every Tuesday. And Senator, this is the, when you set foot on this stage tonight, it's the first time I ever met you." And, of course, they had actually met before. And also, he doesn't preside over the Senate every Tuesday. He goes over to the Senate every Tuesday and meets with the Republican caucus. But if Edwards had just said, well, he first said that and then said, also, you know, maybe I didn't want to come up to you when you're in the Senate because I just, you know, I didn't feel like having someone tell me to go fuck myself. I think we would have won the election if he had done that. Don't you? What we have to do is work. Paul Wellstone said it best. He said, the future belongs to those who are passionate and work hard. And you've got a race here in Colorado that you can win against, what's her name, Yeah, that one we got to win. And the only way you win is neighbor to neighbor. I knew we were going to lose the election last fall when I'm taking the Metroliner down to Washington to do a radio show, and I'm talking to a guy, and he said, well, this is like the Friday or Thursday before the election. He says, well, my wife's in Michigan campaigning for Kerry, and my psychiatrist is in Pennsylvania. And I went, hey, we're going to lose. Because you don't, a psychiatrist from wherever this guy was from, New York or Philadelphia, or, well, if he's Philadelphia, maybe you do, but he wasn't. He was from New York or Washington. You don't want, and that was, well, people were very well intended and would go to Florida and campaign. It works neighbor to neighbor. It works neighbor to neighbor. So look around you. Look around you. These are your neighbors. You guys work together. You guys start, I hope there's a chapter here called Drinking Liberally. Do you know that group? Just get to know each other and build social capital and get trained. You know, I'm on the board of Wellstone Action, and one thing Wellstone Action does is train people to be activists and train them to know how to phone bank and train them to know how to go door to door and train candidates and train campaign managers. And that's how, and organize, and that's how Paul won. The future belongs to those who are passionate and work hard. And that's where I'm going to end it. So be passionate, work hard.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Walter Kern, Nicholas Sparks, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 16th, 2005.